This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. It's a real buzzword these days in the world of integrative medicine, but it's not just an integrative or holistic diagnosis. It's actually now recognized as a major cause of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, a condition which in the past we thought, well, you know, got to learn to live with it. You know, you got a nervous stomach, you know, take some medications that kind of tranquilize your bowel, maybe take an antidepressant, take a lot of fiber, take, you know, some Metamucil. And that was it. And the SIBO concept has really opened us up to a whole world of possibilities in terms of relieving even lifelong symptoms. Right, Dr. Seebecker?
It is so true. You just explained it and put it so beautifully. You know, we're in this time period now where we have made some advancements, gained some understanding in this mysterious condition of IBS. And we can go one layer deeper now in our treatment. I will say that we're not at the deepest layer and we're trying to get there, but it is so much more beneficial than just doing all those things you said, which are just treating all the symptoms with different medicines. That was frustrating.
Indeed. So can you give us the details on the upcoming summit? Because I want to get that in here before we talk about testing and treatment of SIBO.
Absolutely. It's called the SIBO SOS Summit, and this is part two. We did a part one in June of 2017, and there were so many fabulous interviews, we couldn't fit them all in part one. So we did a second one. It's occurring now, October 21st to 29th, and like all summits, it's free. There's around six interviews you can watch a day. In fact, we keep them up for 2 days. And you know, our mission is just to raise awareness of this condition and help educate on it and help the people who are suffering from it and the doctors who are practitioners who are treating people with it. We do actually have a continuing education package. So this is a summit that's both for doctors and patients. Mm-hmm. And we have a broad spectrum of speakers from all the way from gastroenterologists and many other kinds of doctors, chiropractors, naturopaths. But then we also have patients who've been through it and are successful. And we have nutritionists and health coaches. So we're really just trying to give something to everyone who would want to listen to it. It is really phenomenal. I have to say, one of the things that's, pardon me, I just need to cough for a second here.
Sure.
So special about this one is that we have a lot of my hometown, I'm from Portland, Oregon, colleagues who treat a lot of SIBO.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, by the way, Portland seems to be really a mecca for natural treatment of digestive disorders. We just talked to one of your good colleagues, Mark Davis, who I believe he's relocated to the East Coast, but he really kind of made his bones in Portland in working with patients with inflammatory bowel disease, IBD.
He's a dear friend of mine.
Indeed, I'm sure.
He used to just work right down the street from me here. So yeah, it's one of the reasons why Portland is a hotbed is because we have the naturopathic college here, now called the National University of Natural Medicine, although it used to be called naturopathic medicine. They've expanded. So you know, we all go here. We graduated here. I lived in Portland before I even went to the school here. So lucky for me, I get to kind of stay because this is where I live. But like you said, with Dr. Davis, I have so many colleagues. What happened was when I got into SIBO, I joined up with my gastroenterology professor, Dr. Sandberg Lewis, and we began teaching. And so all of our colleagues who are here and at the school, we began teaching. We put SIBO into the curriculum, into the medical school, and I've been teaching it for years. And so we've got a lot of people now who've been practicing for a long time here. So what we've done in this summit is we've gotten them to speak. And what's special here is that unlike myself or Dr. Davis, who, you know, will do interviews and we're maybe more media savvy, a lot of my colleagues, they don't do any of that. They're not on social media. They're just working docs that are in their office. No one would know about them or anything about their experience. And that's one of the beautiful things about this summit is we're getting people like that to be exposed and help get their information out, whereas the only way anyone would know normally is if they saw them in office. So anyway, I think the summit is truly incredible, and I hope people will check it out.
And how might they do that? They can go on Facebook, or they can just go to SIBO Summit.
It's SIBOSOS.com. That's the
SIBOSOS.com. Okay.
Landing page. Yeah.
Great. So how do you know that you have SIBO? You know, you have some GI symptoms, but you really want to know, is it due to bacterial overgrowth? Is there, in the past, we were sort of bedeviled with the Candida diagnosis because, well, how do you diagnose Candida? Well, you know, you can look for Candida in the stool, but you could still have Candida if you don't have a lot of Candida in the stool. And most people do have some Candida in the stool, so it's not necessarily diagnostic. You can do skin tests, but a lot of people react to it and don't necessarily have it. You can, you know, do a swab culture of virtually every orifice of the body. But the problem might be a deep-seated problem, or you might have a hypersensitivity to Candida. That's kind of, you know, the way it works. And it's almost like you might do an empirical trial of treatment to see if people get better. You know, it's kind of like Nancy Pelosi said, we're going to find out what's in the bill after we pass the bill.
Well, very well said. Luckily, our diagnosis for SIBO is not as elusive as Candida. And because there's conditions like Candida and just general dysbiosis and about 40 or 45 other conditions that can cause the exact same symptoms, you need to test because there's no way we would know otherwise. There's been articles published saying, you know, you cannot diagnose SIBO and symptoms alone because there are 40 other things that could cause it.
Yeah, so, and very serious things too. So you don't want to just, God forbid somebody has a more serious underlying problem and you just say, oh, SIBO, change your diet and take some herbs. Well, that would be a real miscalculation.
It's not a good idea. Yeah. Thank you. So what we do is we do a breath test, and it's a lactulose breath test that we do for 3 hours. That is the best way to diagnose it. And it can be done at home with a kit that you then mail in, or it can be done in a doctor's office who has a machine, or even in a hospital that has a machine. And it's pretty simple. It takes, about 3.5 hours. The test is 3 hours long. You do need to do a special prep diet the day before, sometimes 2 days before, and you fast overnight. You know, you just stop eating from, say, around 8 p.m. or 7 p.m. and then take the test in the morning. And that's how it's done. So I really would recommend if someone is thinking that they have it, that they ask for the test and get the test done and find out for sure. Mm-hmm.
And they measure hydrogen. And I remind people that hydrogen is what brought the Hindenburg down. You know, don't light a cigarette too close to your breath exhalations. Well, I'm just joking. It's not going to be that volatile. But that's some pretty intense stuff. That's hydrogen that's produced by a fermentive process by all the bacteria that are furiously pumping out waste products in your gastrointestinal tract.
Yes, and the two main gas waste products that they pump out is hydrogen and methane. And you do need to make sure the tests that you're getting will test for methane as well. Mm-hmm. Most of them do, but it's interesting. There are older machines, and not all machines will test for methane. So I think SIBO's come into consciousness enough that is happening less and less now, but it's amazing. You know, there can be people in maybe more rural areas where they go to the hospital to get it and they don't even use the machine that tests for methane, or their machine tests for methane, but they don't even put it on the report because they don't know that it's important. So
methane, otherwise known as swamp gas, right? Yes. Hydrogen is an odorless gas, but need I say more about methane? What if you have high levels of methane? Does that indicate a different type of SIBO than if you have high levels of hydrogen?
Yeah, and actually, methane is actually odorless too. We think that it has a smell.
Oh, because because it's toxic, they add something to it so you don't get asphyxiated by it. Okay, yeah.
That's it, yes. Yeah. But that gas is associated with and actually known to cause constipation. So it actually interferes with the neurology in the intestinal tract and slows motility and can cause constipation. So this is pretty mind-blowing because I'm sure there's people listening thinking, wait, are you saying that my constipation all these years could have been caused by a gas that's inside of me from a bacteria? Yeah. So actually, bacteria can cause, technically they're archaea, but can cause constipation. And that's not a concept that a lot of people think of. Mm-hmm. You know, they think, usually they blame it on the fact, like, because their doctor has told them, I'm not drinking enough water or something, you know, it's like, no. So that's very important to get both of these gases tested. Now, there is a third gas that we don't have the machinery to test for yet, although that's coming, and that's hydrogen sulfide. That one does H2S. Have a smell. Yeah. That one smells. And so that's why we need the 3-hour test at this time, because it's in the third hour that we can tell whether or not a person has hydrogen sulfide or not. So those are the three gases. And it's very important to know what they are, because they have different treatments. Mm-hmm. Methane gas requires different herbs and different antibiotics if you're doing either of those options. And actually, so does hydrogen sulfide. So we need to know what the gases are so we know how to treat a person. And also, so we have a sense of how long it's going to take and give a proper estimate. Because methane is harder to treat and usually will take longer. So when we have all this information from our tests, we can then treat better. So we, you know, not only do we need to know if this is the condition, we need to know which gases are there and how high.
And is diet important in the treatment of this? Because as you mentioned earlier, one of your colleagues, I believe it's Dr. Pimentel, treats with a medication, but he always insists that his patients follow a diet because he knows it's going to be more effective when you do the right thing food-wise.
It's very, very helpful, very effective. I mean, ultimately, I haven't been able to see diet be a curative treatment on its own. However, not to diminish its extreme importance as one of the treatments and one of the adjunct therapies, it helps with symptoms probably more than anything. More than anything a person could do, except, of course, if you can eradicate the bacteria with antimicrobials, whichever those might be. But it is so helpful for symptoms. And the basic premise here is that, as you mentioned, these gases are being made out of fermentation. And that's just kind of the word for when bacteria are eating and they make gas. And they ferment carbohydrates primarily. That's their number one food source. And carbohydrates are, you know, an entire macronutrient group of foods. So that even includes vegetables and fruits, as well as grains. It's not just like sweet baked goods, like a lot of people think when they think of carbohydrates, you know, they think, oh, sugary foods, but it's regular good foods too. Nuts, seeds, vegetables, fruits. So these diets that are made for SIBO, they find ways to bring down the carbohydrates. So they're lower carbohydrate diets, and they are very helpful. And it, you know, besides just bringing down the symptoms, they just also help with the whole treatment. And so many people additionally have this chronically. And let's say they have an underlying disease that there is no known cure for that causes SIBO. That happens frequently. And so they're going to be dealing with chronic SIBO. Well, diet comes into play here as really the best tool to manage that condition, this condition, ongoing and long term. So it is so helpful.
So in other words, you can push back against your underlying condition's tendency to set you up for SIBO through doing some of the right things. You're not necessarily relegated to a lifetime of suffering if you do some of the right things.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, so many people get so much better. I mean, I mean the chronic people. So they might have chronic SIBO. They're not technically cured, but they're 100% symptom free, you know, and maybe they relapse once a year, once every 2 years. I mean, I have systemic sclerosis patients in whom that condition, you would assume they would always have SIBO, who honestly eat a broader diet than other just starting out patients that I have with no symptoms. So very, very good help.
So importantly, you know, and there's going to be a lot more detail, obviously, in the summit, but could you name some of your favorite botanicals? You know, I'm not asking for a cookbook approach, but what are some of the options?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's two approaches that physicians use. One is sort of like a big combination of all antimicrobial herbs. And beyond that, like antiparasitic, anti-yeast, you know, antifungal, all these herbs together. That's popular with a lot of physicians. I myself prefer the single herb approach, where I like to really pick and choose. And so my favorite herbs are berberine containing herbs like golden seal or Oregon grape, or I'll just use a product that says berberine complex or berberine, you know, something like that. That's a great antibacterial. And then I really also like oregano, which is great antifungal as well, but excellent antibacterial. And then neem, N-E-E-M, excellent antibacterial. And those are great for the hydrogen producing bacteria. But for the methane producing bacteria, we have to use one of two things. The main one is allicin, which is the extract. Sounds just like my name, mm-hmm. Which is the
extract. Spelled different. Yeah.
Antibacterial extract that is from garlic. And we don't prefer to use whole garlic because whole garlic is very fermentable by bacteria. And
it's interesting. One of our sponsors here on Intelligent Medicine is Kyolic, aged garlic extract. And I love that product, but it's allicin free. So for, you know, I prescribe it for all manner of things, cardiovascular prevention and blood pressure and, you know, all immune system support. It's great, but it doesn't contain allicin. And you need the allicin for SIBO, so you actually, there's a different product that I use called AlliMax, which I think is...
Yes, I use AlliMed. Well. Okay. Absolutely. AlliMed is just the strongest. AlliMax is the lowest dose. AlliUltra is the middle dose. We use AlliMed all the time. It's really what we use. That's what we use. So when a person has either constipation with their situation or we know they have methane gas, we must use the AlliMed with one of the other herbs. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way we do it. I usually combine two herbs. So like say berberine herbs with AlliMed, or if a person does not, or could be oregano and AlliMed or neem and AlliMed. And then if a person does not have the methane, then I will combine from the other. So maybe berberine and neem together or oregano and berberine, something like that. So that's how we do it. We do it for about a month. And we find that we need longer with herbs than we do with typical pharmaceutical antibiotic course. So those are the main herbs to treat SIBO, and they're very, very effective. And like I said, there's another whole way people like to do it where they use these big combination formulas. Mm-hmm. The reason mm-hmm. I don't tend to do it that way is that I see a lot of patients that are very sensitive and reactive. It's a lot easier for me to figure out what is bothering someone if I'm only giving them two things. So,
right, yeah, they're combo products. You know, one of the ones that I like is called, it's a system. There's Candibactin AR, which is the aromatic herbs, including oregano and some others, and then there's Candibactin BR, and the B, I guess, stands for berberine, which is the main constituent, but there are other things in it. And that's kind of like the 1-2 punch that I sometimes use. So different strokes for different folks.
That combination is very similar to the approach I use because the BR is just berberine, okay. And the AR only has three, you know, it's thyme, oregano, I believe, and lemon sage or lemongrass, one of those. Mm-hmm. So it's like basically, it's not a huge combo. So that one I use very often. When I say the big combos, I mean, it's got like 25 different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I like to get a little bit more. And also the potency we need is quite high. The dosing we need is quite high on a lot of these, particularly berberine. And so if you use a big product like that, you often can't get the dose you need. And then, you know, we just have to add in the AlliMed. That's a very important thing. If someone's listening and their doctor is treating them and they don't have that allicin in and they have methane, you do need to add that.
Interesting. Also, I want to ask you about way to promote motility, because you know, it's fine to eradicate these bad bacteria. After all, this is bacterial overgrowth. But if you don't enhance or support motility, it's going to be kind of like a sluggish stream, and the bacteria are going to reaccumulate in your gut ultimately, because you can't kill them all. You don't want to kill them all, because that would be, you know, sterilizing a person. What are some natural ways to get your GI system peristalsing again?
Well, first and foremost is think about that stress that we talked about in part one, and give yourself some opportunity to not be in fight or flight. Mm-hmm. So that's first off.
Because the parasympathetic state, which is sort of the relaxed state, favors digestion. That's why eating on the run, you know, not a great idea, because it's just going to stultify your digestive processes.
And, you know, it's so interesting. You think about so many people, let's say they're in their morning, they're at their work and they're in school, and all they're thinking about is, oh, I can't wait till lunch, you know. Then lunch comes and then they're just thinking about the work they have to do in the afternoon, you know. Yeah. So we just be present, take a breath or two, say something for gratitude, prayer or, you know, grace or whatever it is, or just something to ground yourself into what you're doing and enjoy your food, you know. Right. But the other thing we can do is not eat between our meals, like not snack. So the migrating motor complex happens when we are fasting, which means not eating. And also it means don't taking caloric beverages. So actually not snacking is better for SIBO. Now this can be, it's really interesting. This can be hard for people with hypoglycemia. Although when you do go on a SIBO type diet, being that they're lower carbohydrate and higher protein and fat, that usually stabilizes a lot of people's blood sugar. But what I usually say is just go as long as you comfortably can. I mean, if you have another condition where you have to eat more often, then you do it. It really helps. So the suggestion would be at least 4 hours in between meals without eating. 5 is even better, but, you know, 4 if you can. And I have to say that when I institute this in my patients, we can almost always tell a difference. Now, on the other hand, I will say that we know that the symptoms come from eating, because then the bacteria make gas and the gas produces all the symptoms. So on the other hand, this also helps just because it's more time away from food. Mm-hmm. But I do believe it really does help motility, because it allows it to occur. If you're eating, there isn't even the chance for this migrating motor complex to happen, because eating turns it off. So those are some main natural things you can do. I also think
herbs or things that
oh yes,
like, for example, I recommend sometimes Swedish bitters to people who have a sluggish digestion. I believe there's some herbs that are called cholagogues in there, if I'm not mistaken. That's your forte, because you went to naturopathic school.
Yeah. So there are then some natural prokinetics. I mean, bitters is a very mild help in that, but I wouldn't consider that a main prokinetic. So for prokinetics, those are things that stimulate and amplify and coordinate gastrointestinal motility. They are not meant to stimulate a bowel movement, so they're not laxatives. They are really meant to stimulate the migrating motor complex. That's the whole point. And typically we choose from 3 natural and 3 pharmaceutical. So the 3 natural ones we choose from are Iberogast. That's a herbal combination product originally from Germany that's been studied and shown to have prokinetic activity. So I really like that we know for sure it works as a prokinetic. Actually, it performed better than 2 pharmaceutical prokinetics in the study. That was sisapride and metoclopramide. Iberogast performed better.
Which, by the
way,
are banned. At least one of them is as of last checking, because of the brain symptoms they cause. They cause neurological problems.
They are both off the U.S. market. Yeah. So Iberogast performed better. Good to know. Yeah. So that one, and then plain ginger, just ginger root, usually at around 1,000 milligrams, that we know works as prokinetic, particularly within the stomach. And when it stimulates that stomach MMC, that's short for migrating motor complex, it also stimulates the upper small intestine MMC at the same time. So good choice there. And then another one we often use is a combination product called Modal Pro, which has ginger in it and some other ingredients. So those are some of our main ones we use. The pharmaceutical ones are prucalopride, which is one of the only truly safe pharmaceutical prokinetics that I know of. And then low-dose erythromycin. Erythromycin is an antibiotic, but at its low dose, it's famous as a prokinetic. And then lastly, low-dose naltrexone, which is LDN.
And LDN is not domperidone, which is
domperidone is another option. You know, technically it's off our market in the U.S.
You can get it from Canada though, and many even standard gastros obtain it for their patients from Canada.
Yes, that's what we do with prucalopride. Prucalopride hasn't yet come to the U.S. Okay. It's not in the U.S. because of safety reasons. It was political. It never even came here. It's coming. We get it from Canada, but the domperidone, you know, it's interesting. It's had a lot of safety concern and a lot of articles written about it. However, you know, I have a lot of international patients, and their gastroenterologists always have them on it, particularly with various conditions, certain conditions, it's standard of care. So I never have seen anyone have any dangerous reactions. And so I took another look at the literature, and interestingly, some articles have been out in recent years really questioning the original concerns. So I wrote to one of my friends, gastroenterologist, who is a clinical pharmacologist, and I asked him what he thought. And he did a review for me, so kind of him. And he said, you know what? I think it is okay. He said, you just want to make sure that they don't have pre-existing heart condition. But other than that, Really, it's okay. So that's another option. I will say that I see prucalopride working better than that. That is really probably one of the best prokinetics I've ever seen.
New kid on the block because it's not yet available here.
I mean, it's been around for a good 20 years in Europe. A lot of good safety studies.
Okay. That's a clinical pearl. Hey, you know, I always learn a huge amount from you, Allison. You're a great teacher. And that's what you intend to do with this SIBO SOS Summit.
That's what it is, yes.
Bring to the fore some of the top experts in the field, yourself included, and people can learn a tremendous amount. And I think perhaps unlock the key to their particular GI problems or even systemic problems, because they can be related. And I also recommend it heartily for all my clinician listeners. There's a big population of health practitioners who listen to Intelligent Medicine. I'm very flattered that you should find it useful. And this is really essential, cutting-edge information. And remind us once again how people can access it.
Yes, it's at SIBOSOS, so SIBOSOS.com. And we would love to have you join us. And I just want to give you a big thanks, Dr. Hoffman. It's such a pleasure to speak with you, as always, and you do a fantastic job.
Well, we're getting the word out. That's our mutual mission statement, and you do an admirable job of messaging on this subject. You've really revolutionized our approach to SIBO. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All the best on the SIBO SOS Summit. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.